Well, this is, we're turning final here, as old bush pilots say. That means you're committed to land shortly. So this is our last session. It runs slightly abbreviated because the Esalen machine likes you to go back to your room and have everything out for the next crew of aspirants by noon. So we'll end shortly after 11:30 or at 11:30. And the intent is that you clear your room and then you're welcome to come back and have lunch and drift to your separate homes. So this session is a wrap-up session. Mark has some things he wants to say. This is your last chance to get a crack at us in this context. If there's something that's been burning as an issue for you that didn't get dealt with, it's your obligation to get it out for us. Mark, why don't you work with it?
I just have some basic housekeeping notes. First off, this weekend has been renamed Letting Go and Moving On. And I'm taking an informal, unscientific survey to find out whether the event at the end of time is to be called the Eschaton or the Eschaton. And I'd just like to note for those of you who heard my rap yesterday about planning on doing something and then getting up the next morning and not doing it at all, then in fact I wasn't talking about Saturday morning, but I was talking about Sunday morning.
Did yoga not happen?
Yes, it did. No, yoga did happen, all five of us.
Uh-huh. The few.
The few and the proud and the enormously relaxed. This morning I have deborged myself for you. I am not wearing my nicotine patch and I've popped my contact lenses out and I have my funky little Japanese eyeglasses on. In part because this is the part that I want to be the most authentic. And what you're seeing now and for the rest of the morning hopefully will be the real me, as close as I know what the real me is. So I've taken off all of the masks, except for the dye in my hair, and that's a bit more complicated. We've been tracing out a line. I've sort of been talking about my work over a period of time, and we'd run along, and now we're coming to early 1996. And in early 1996, the web has taken off, and Vermal is starting to take off. And I'm now faced with the question. I'm not an artist and I don't even play one in VR. I have a vision. I'm an engineer. I can write code and make certain things happen. But now I've participated in this stone soup that gave the world VRML and I'm faced with what do I do with it? And what happened, what I was driven to, was this original vision that I had about the body of the planet floating in cyberspace. And it happened really sort of slowly. Pieces started sort of filtering in. I started to see that that was here, and that was here, and that was here. And one of the things that we almost don't notice about the web is that the web allows you not only to find out things, but it allows you to pull things and pull them together in a very broad way. You can take specific pieces and use them in your own work. So that it's not just this storehouse of knowledge, but it's now this combinatorial matrix that new forms can emerge out of. And all of a sudden, I discovered John Walker's website. John Walker is the founder of Autodesk, and from what I've heard, terrifyingly bright man. And John Walker has a thing about space, and he has a thing about satellites. And in particular, he has a thing about meteorological satellites. And he's a mathematician and a programmer. And so what he can do is he can take all the nice, lovely images that all the nice, lovely weather satellites are taking of the Earth all the time. And if you've seen a weather satellite, well, it's the Earth, right? It's this nice spherical image of the Earth from the position of the view of this weather satellite, which is fine and dandy if you just want to look at a picture. But because he's a wily mathematician, he can actually take that picture and then stretch it out for you so it looks like a flat surface. It's as if you're taking the globe or a section of the globe and laying it out. When I saw that that was available, the final light bulb went off and I set to work. Because these satellite images are updated hourly. They come in to NASA or NOAA into their computers. They shoot up to computers in Minnesota. They get more processed. And then they shoot over to computers in Switzerland and get even more processed. And once they're over in those computers in Switzerland, then I was able to do something with them. And what I did was I took this literal real-time photograph of the Earth's surface and broke it up into a mosaic of tiles and laid these tiles across a globe. So what you get as a result in 3D is what I called, when I was done with it, Web Earth. And what it is it's as if you're above the Earth, floating above the Earth, looking down on it. And it doesn't take a supercomputer, and it doesn't take a T1 connection, because I didn't have either of those things when I was working. What it takes is any sort of PC, any sort of net connection, and a willingness to click to the URL that I've written far too small up there. But you can copy it down later. The idea behind that was that I'd seen works like T-Vision, which are big, high-end sort of production enterprises, operas, as it were, and all I just wanted to do was write a rock and roll song with a catchy tune.
Someone Christ of the Jews.
Something like that. And, and I spent really only about a week working on this. It was really just a matter of working at integrating the data and testing it and getting it all up. And when it was up and I had this 3D model of the planet, which updates itself every hour, so you can see the weather systems as they move across the body of the planet. When it was up, after these 5 days of work, I actually broke down crying in front of the monitor, because at the end, I'd come back to where I'd started, or at least I'd started to come back to where I'd started, because it's not an end point. It's a beginning point, but somehow I'd managed to take this psychedelic revelation, and through a lot of magic and a lot of time and a lot of will on the part of a lot of people, produce this object. And this object is my offering to the web. It's my offering to you. It's not meant to be an end point, but it's meant to be a beginning. It's being capable of saying, look at us. This is where we are right now. This is what's going on. Let's take a look. Let's play with scale. Let's play with time. Let's play with all the different ways of taking a look at all the ways we interconnect, so we can understand that, so that we can work the planet better, so we can become this seamless informational entity that understands itself and its own processes so well that it corrects the errors in these processes very quickly and improves the flow for those processes for all of the processes that are involved. It's silly and probably egotistical to cry at your own work. What I didn't expect was that when other people saw it, they would cry. And that's when I suspected I'd come to the authentic. Because it's simple. It's not much code. It was a little thought, and it was the pooling of resources. But what it evokes in people, what I've seen it evoke in people, appears to be an authentic reaction of recognition. We've talked in here about what happens to the astronauts when they get to space and they behold the body of the planet. And there's an old joke that there was some sort of space expo, perhaps in France, in the 1960s. And there was some sort of Gemini capsule, and they managed to talk a cosmonaut and an American astronaut in it. And they got in it, and they closed the doors, and it sealed off. And the cosmonaut turns to the astronaut and says, "So did you see God up there too?" And it's the authentic question, because there's something about the information of perceiving the body of the planet as a whole that is radically transformative. And for the moment, we can't all shoot ourselves into orbit for that point of view. But what I found, at least in a gentle echo, is that works like WebEarth have the capability of producing the same in us. And I think that it's a question of intent. There's no reason that there aren't 100,000 other things like this. All of the source code for this I've made freely available, because basically I want other people to take it and run with it and add to it and whatever, add their own databases. I'm starting to now look at what they call brownfields. Brownfields are these toxic zones that aren't toxic enough to be classified as Superfund sites, but are still toxic. And with one of my friends that I've known for 20 years, and we're thinking of maybe starting to add these in there and census data and so on and so forth. And maybe if we work hard at this, we can get a stone soup going around that. But it doesn't have to happen all at one place. It's the web. It can happen anywhere, and a bunch of different people can turn out a bunch of different things all the time, if where they're working from is their heart. And that's my own humble offering in that domain. It's certainly not everything that it could be. You can't zoom in and see yourself standing on the street corner, though I'm sure that's not far away. You can't click on your own house. You can't knock on someone's door electronically by coming down to spy on them. You can't see birds in flight or populations in migration yet. All you can see is the clouds floating by on a blue sphere.
But if everybody who had global data poured it into this kind of filing system, is what it is, then you could have flow of petroleum, electrical grids, positions of ships at sea, where everyone with a Brazilian passport was at any given moment.
Right.
So it's like reconstruct. It's some kind of alchemical data reconstruction of the real world on every level,
ultimately,
if it were carried out.
It's 5 billion stars on a naked planet.
Well, you know, Joyce, when he wrote Finnegan's Wake, in some interview he gave at the time, he said that his goal was to write a book so complexified that if the universe were to be destroyed, you could reconstruct it in all its detail from the book.
Do you think that there's that's the analysis?
A perfect understanding would mean you could create a perfect simulacrum of something. I mean, that's what I think understanding is. So if you had a perfect understanding of the atmosphere, the geology, the biology, the sociology of the planet, you ought to be able to recreate it.
Do you think, and Mark, in on this too, that we're being compelled, or this thing is compelling itself to be visualized like that for some other reason? Something else is compelling it to create this
simulacrum? It's very, the image itself is very seductive, and that's telling us something. The seductiveness of the image means that it has a propensity to reproduce.
The other question is, given a perfect simulacrum, What is the difference between it and what is synchronous?
It converges on it. It's never perfect. It converges on it.
And then the perspective of the beholder. You know, this discussion reminds me of the passage in the I Ching. I think it's the commentary on the hexagram before completion, where it says, if the sacrifice is correctly carried out, you may hold the universe in the palm of your hand like a spinning marble. So it's like, it is an alchemical goal. It's the philosopher's stone, because the philosopher's stone is all and everything immediately apprehended and beheld, and this is what this would result in. It's funny to show you how different Mark and I must be at some fundamental level. For years I've had this idea in the back of my mind for my fantasy interface for the World Wide Web. What would it look like? And I've also had a rap, which you were spared this weekend, which is all about how what we need to do at the end of history is turn ourselves inside out. That somehow we needed to bring the soul into visible manifestation, and the body would become a freely commandable object in the imagination. You know, it would have super strength. It could fly. It could swim underwater. Well, in this process of exploring this metaphor, turn inside out, I came upon the image in a psychedelic trip of an interface to the World Wide Web where when you came online, you would burst into a space, and it's Mark's object, but turned inside out and with the point of view at the center of it. So as you turn 360 degrees, you would see Africa, right. Asia, Australia, and everything would be lit up with colored pipelines of light, right. That would designate the various websites, and then you would just spin in this global dimension and then point and rush in and into the connections. So obviously, at the end of our philosophical umbilical cord is this weird image of the total planet as a living, integrated, and it's more than an image. As Mark pointed out, it's not simply how it appears in ordinary light to human vision. It's the data image. It's all must be there, you know, the geology, the economics, the religious warfare, the history, everything brought to a point. When we've talked about the eschaton here and at other times, what it is it's a bringing of everything together. You know, there have been lots of haggles ever since the 1940s about defining information. In fact, Gregory Bateson in this very room offered one of the best definitions of information. He said information is any difference that makes a difference. But the way I think of information and complexification is it has to do with density of connectivity. And so my image of the end state of the attractor is, in mathematical terms, it's a space in which all points are cotangent. The first philosopher in the West to stumble onto the necessity of this concept was Leibniz. And he had this idea of what he called the monad. Leibniz was accused of inventing the smallest form of God because his monads were perfect hologrammatic fractal reflections of the entire cosmos. But he said the only way one monad differs from another, or can possibly differ from another, is by its perspective on the other monads given its position in the matrix in which it occurs. So this convergence thing is all information, all data is becoming cotangent. This can't happen in matter. matter has exclusionary principles, where it says if there's an electron here, there can't be another electron precisely here, only one electron per electron space. But in some kind of data space, all this stuff can be funneled together. And that's really what human history is it's all being rolled up into a ball, and then the ball is being recompacted. It's a kind of reverse enactment of what happened to matter at the Big Bang, but it's happening to information here at the end of the story. Just a thought, you know.
On a different tangent, I have one last magical act this weekend. It's an exorcism. You all have to help me let go and move on. From my recent trip to the Magic Kingdom, I'll put this on, and I want you to take a good look at it, because it is an object so fantastic, so unspeakable, that I simply had to own it. Yes, they sell this at Walt Disney World.
It should be on the flag. It's like your first look at a swastika.
Thank you. And when I saw it, the sick thing was I knew I had to have it because no one would believe me.
How much was it?
$16.
$16.
I need to leave it on while I conduct this exorcism, and I will need your help. So this is an audience participation part of the program. I went to SIGGRAPH this year, which was held in Orlando this year, as it was in 94. And I arranged my schedule very carefully so that on Monday, when things generally don't happen at SIGGRAPH, I could take one of my best friends to the Magic Kingdom for his birthday. And we got up bright and early, and we rode into the gates of Disney World and traveled through the park to the happiest place on earth. And because I knew I was going to need some level of chemical irony, we ate mushrooms. Just enough. Because I knew I was going to need, I suppose you could think of it as an insulator layer between the reality of Mickey and the reality of the cosmos. And the mushrooms start to hit, we go on a scary ride and it's fun, but then we come out and we're in Tomorrowland, and I see the object, and I didn't even know ahead of time that this is where I had to go, and I didn't know till afterward that I had to go there, and I enter the Carousel of Progress. The Carousel of Progress was created for the 1964 World's Fair in New York. It was, as John Cameron Swayze narrates at the beginning, Walt's favorite ride. It really summed up everything that he thought about the world. And the ride is very interesting because you sit in chairs, you're an audience, there's a proscenium, and you move around a proscenium. And every time that you rotate through the proscenium, there's a song, which we'll come to in a moment.
That's all right, John.
But the first time you rotate, you're facing a scene, and it's America at the turn of the century, probably right before Principia Mathematica and the ultraviolet catastrophe solution. And America is mostly rural, according to the scene, and it's it's Valentine's Day, and this gentleman in a chair is telling us about how great it is at the turn of the century. It's animatronic, of course. And he's telling us about all the great innovations, and he's heard about this thing called the telephone, and they're going to be getting electric power in here before too long, and blah, 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 blah. And now we're about to move, and there's a song. And the song goes like this. Now is the time, now is the best time, now is the best time of your life. And the stage moves, and we're in the 1920s. And in the 1920s, there's now an electrical outlet with more plugs in it than I've ever seen. And there's a fan going, because it's now we've gone to the 4th of July in this 1920-ish era, and there's a radio in the background. And once again, this gentleman is talking about how great everything is and how all the new innovations are absolutely wonderful. And how good it is. It's all good. And once again, we move to the next scene and we get the song. Now is the time. Now is the best time. Now is the best time of your life. And all of a sudden, we're in a kitchen circa 1946, which, because swing is very hip right now, I actually want to move into. It's, you know, the vinyl and the curved couches. I'm like, wow, that's actually really, really hip. And there are kitchens in L.A. like this. So, I like it. I'm already at home. And we now have achieved the era of the dishwasher. And the really nice refrigerator, and all of these things that are just talking about how wonderful it is. And that gentleman is sitting in the chair and he's telling us how wonderful it is. And now, well, after that era is over, and it's Halloween, by the way, we now go to the last part. All together now. Now is the time. Now is the best time. Now is the best time of your life. Now, of course, this ride was constructed in 1964, and so these were designed to be 20-year intervals. But Disney's Imagineers have been hard at work. So all of a sudden, we go from 1946 to Christmas Day in 1998. Wham! And it's a suburban living room, and it's night, and the family are playing with their Christmas gifts. And it turns out that Junior's gotten a fully immersive VR system for Christmas. And he's got a data glove, and it's showing up on the TV screen so the whole family can sit around and watch, and then Grandma gets in there and whoops his ass at the Space War game. This was my moment of ontological discontinuity. Around this. In some ways, I am compelled to feel responsible for what gets done with VR, not because I invented it or created it, but in part because I've been trying to use my own voice and my own heart to help direct some of where it's going. And I sat in a theater, in a theme park, in a state that had practically burnt to the ground 2 weeks before, because the climate is not quite right, next to a state where it hasn't rained, and I don't think it still has rained in 3 months, coming from a state that practically melted into the ocean, because something's wrong, because things are not balancing anymore, because all of a sudden we go from 1946 to 1998 and nothing is making any sense. But in fact, what's being held before us is a virtual reality that's not allowing us to articulate the real, but is being used as the mechanism to flee from it. And that was the moment I got ill. Because entertainment is fine. There's no issue there. But the thought that, in fact, the future that awaits us is not grounded in any way in what we are, in the real or in the planet, That, to me, is horrifying. And this part of the morning's talk is really called a new story, because we have to be able to, in some sense, take a look at those stories when they pop up. And we can say, well, yeah, now is the time, now is the best time. But is that the story that I'm buying? What am I being sold on that tab of reality? What's going on here? Do I want to be using it to flee? Is it because of the processes that have been set up by capital and market formation and consensus and advertising that this is just the logical product? Do I have to buy into this? And of course, the hidden ethic of Disney as a corporation, as a media giant, is that you absorb the media on all different levels of intensity, and of course you come to the theme park when you want the intensified experience of information. It's really an amplification of what you'll get on ABC or on the Disney Channel or in the movies, blah, 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 blah. And so what they're doing is they're selling me a reality. And I decided at that moment, at this profound ontological level, that I wasn't buying it. And I think once we say that, there's a space that opens up. And the space that opens up is the space for the new stories and what we do and how we work and how we talk to each other and how we love and how we connect and how we create is in that space of new stories. And those new stories are the old stories, because the present is an archaic revival. But those stories are new stories because we have this endless engine of creativity, of art, that we can plumb, that we can move into, to tell us the stories about what's really going on. Tell us the stories about history ending, and make that comforting. Make the eschaton a yeschaton. Get us comfortable with that. Get us comfortable with all the changes that are being invoked by the engines of time.
How do you mean?
I mean, you could say that, but sort of all the forces that are in play, you can go to someone and say, you know, we should really use technology to investigate the earth and come to some sort of understanding, and all these nice things, but this doesn't seem like forces are going that way, and without any sort of external...
Well, can I get
that? Yeah, go.
I think we're incredibly impatient. I mean, for example, you know, my entire adult life was lived under the shadow of something called the Cold War, which was supposed to eventually end in the end of the world, and the religious and social structures that were in place supported this conclusion. Now the Soviet Union doesn't exist, hasn't for nearly a decade, and there's been a tremendous build down in nuclear weaponry. It isn't that we've come to paradise, but we've certainly, some of the problems that were thought intractable and insoluble have in fact yielded and become part of the historical record. The fact that we could collectively as a global society back away from a race war in South Africa is remarkable. So I think, you know, that very complicated forces are in play at the moment. It's silly to talk about whether the forward movement of history is good or bad. It simply is. But I think, you know, the nation state is on the ropes in the way the church was on the ropes in the early 17th century at the time of the 30 Years' War, and that the new corporate dispensation is different. War is not seen as an instrument of corporate policy. Racism interferes with expanding niche markets. unregulated markets are a pain in the ass to corporatism. So I think the world is restructuring. We haven't yet hit the real test. In other words, technological change, as we've discussed it here, is going to become ever more accelerated. Whether social and political systems can accommodate remains to be seen, but so far there hasn't been a cracking apart yet.
One of the counterarguments I might offer to the question that you very reasonably pose: in the present time, things are very nonlinear. Things change very quickly. The web changed everything about everything, and that was not a project of capital. All right? So projects that have nothing to do with markets or anti-markets or capital or the distribution of anything on this planet that we would normally associate as a power structure have had profound nonlinear influences on our day-to-day lives. And this is only increasing. The system's only getting more unstable. It's not approaching some sort of equilibrium. It's actually getting more unstable. And so it's always an argument about sensitive dependence on initial conditions. When I suggest making a new story, and I don't mean making one new story or just one myth, because that's just as hegemonic as the myth of history, right? It's 10 or 10,000 and send them out into the world. What I'm arguing for, and I want to be very clear on this, is that Disney is magic, and you fight magic with magic. You spin the new words, you spin the stories, you get them out there, you get them eating away at the mouse or everything that it can do, until you get to a myth that you feel satisfied living with, a myth that you think is actually the truth, that is comfortable, even entertaining, because clearly there's room for entertainment there, but you don't want an entertainment that's based fundamentally on blindness and closure. You want an entertainment that's based fundamentally, maybe, on authenticness. All of the old stories, all of the old myths are authentic. This is their manner of transmission, is by the fact that they are authentic. They couldn't be carried any other way. The vessel cannot hold them unless they're authentic. And so when you try to create a culture that's bounded on inauthentic myths, the vessel, in fact, in which it's carried dissolves.
Yeah, I see all this going forward under the notion of the almost the obligation now to create art, that the expansion of human capacity means we're slipping away from the influence of these centrally disseminated artistic canons, Western civilization, Christianity, capitalism, so forth and so on. And the only way to survive in the media environment is to produce it, not consume it. The people who consume it become the spectators to other people's unfoldment. So that's why the new tools for communication are not for graphic designers or special effects people. They're for everybody, because if you're not producing a vision, you are consuming somebody else's vision, and there doesn't seem to me to be much middle ground. What did you say?
I have one. It's on that sort of note, having worked in the interactive field for the last 4 years, you know, there were lots of companies and lots of attention paid to trying to either sort of, you know, build the tools, present the tools, or offer alternatives, you know, that were interactive entertainment, that were essentially consumer-oriented product or things that would allow people to be creative, and all those issues are being grappled with all the time with anyone making content. But part of those concerns are like, does Joe Sixpack really want to, you know, make anything? I mean, aren't there... Don't you think there are real consumers who just really, that's what they want to do?
Of course there's, a room for the seamy side. But on the other hand, the idea that the great unwashed masses are somehow dull is a print-created elitist notion that is absolutely untrue.
And not holding up in the face of the web.
Not holding up in the face of the web. My career is proof that you can use big words and talk to ordinary people and be perfectly understood. So I think this myth of monotypic markets and dumbing everything down is at the convenience of the producer, not the consumer. I recently read Thomas Pynchon's novel Mason and Dixon, which pictures America in the 1760s, right before the Revolution. Well, the level of erudition evidenced by ordinary common people, you know, it was the height of a literary society. To have read the Greeks and the Roman orators and all that was not uncommon. In fact, it was typical. One of the prices we've paid for mass communication is the tabloidization of everything from the Encyclopedia Britannica on down. So, no, I think that given the right social environment, the richness of ordinary human beings is what was sacrificed on the altar of print-created civilization. We were made interchangeable parts in an industrial engine which valued similitude. You know, the concept of the citizen.
When you raise similitude, I mean, that's a real issue, because likewise, people working in VR and VRML, you know, they don't start from ground zero. They're coming, many, from architecture, from traditional design.
Right.
The web is extremely print-driven and oriented. In fact, Mark is really one of the few, you know, visionaries in the web who's purporting, you know, look elsewhere for your models. Don't you know, follow the existing,
But we're all pioneers here. In other words, the bandwidth isn't there yet. The really simple tools aren't there yet. The public doesn't know, even the net-using public.
And if I can, Paul, I think that the seduction of creation is there, but not at the level that it will be. And it's going to be something very nonlinear. It's going to be just like the web. Huh? What's going on, right? Just like the Mac when you saw it. You know, it's going to be something that's very like that. And the fact that we haven't got there, I mean, we're playing in this space, or we're sort of probing the space, and eventually...
Patience.
I don't know if it's patience.
There will be
play.
Virtual realities attached to Eudora as documents. This probably can be done now, except who has the disk size and bandwidth to handle it. But if big machines are talking to each other, it's happening now, and the trickle-down thing is very, very rapid.
When printing was invented, there was a 50-year period called the incunabulary period, where all the things that were printed on the new printing press were intended and conceived to resemble manuscripts that had been made for hundreds, thousands of years. They didn't have another context.
Right.
After the first 50 years, print found its own voice, as it were, and many, many things happened. And this is widely recognized as the incunabulary period of electronic...
Right.
Or digital, or whatever you want to call it, discourse and texts. So be patient and be
and
don't
was,
be afraid.
Wait at happen. Least six more months.
Yeah. Right.
New young people that are using the web want to be creative. They're looking for that. They know they can, and they understand how, and they go and they do it.
And I think a lot of generalities are being made here, because I've worked behind the counter. We did a lot of customer service, and I really don't think that the masses... I've worked in video stores, I've worked in delis, I've worked any place that they consume, and again, I don't make generalities, but people didn't really care about anything innovative coming in. They wanted the next, you know, action film. They didn't want to think. They wanted to vegetate after a hard day at work.
Yeah. They want to be seduced by the hypnosis of media.
Well, the hypnosis of television, though. No, but that's one thing that we're dealing with, is that the mass medium that's dominant in our culture right now is television. And it's a very hypnotic...
But the market studies show that what people are deserting in favor of the web when they reallocate their expendable time is TV. I mean, in other words, they're still having as much sex, they're still walking their dogs as much, they're still hiking in the wilderness as much, but they're slashing their television viewing.
Right.
This is the most this is the best news out of Gomorrah in a while.
Is there Gomorrah.com that you subscribe to?
I own it.
You know, one of the things that strikes me is the value that we've seen from the Internet and World Wide Web has been